Welcome to the deep dive. We are going straight to the source today, cutting through all that endless market noise to give you, well, the enduring playbook for being well-informed about money.
Yeah, our mission here is really about common sense, logic, discipline.
Exactly.
And we're diving deep into the absolute foundation of rational investing, Benjamin Graham's work.
Ah,
Warren
Graham.
Buffett called him the greatest practical investment thinker of all time. And there's a very good reason for that.
Right.
Graham's principles, they've survived. They've thrived across, every single market cycle for the last 90 years. Their value often gets, enhanced after financial storms demolish flimsier ideas.
And his advice wasn't just theory, was it? It was forged in like real fire.
Absolutely. He lived through the great crash of 1929, 1932,
Yeah.
lost nearly 70% of his own money.
Wow, 70%.
Yeah. And he learned from that. He learned that soundness, protecting against permanent loss, that was the only thing that brought unfailing rewards.
That experience really shaped everything you taught, didn't it?
It had to. Because think about it. If you suffer an irreversible loss, say 90%, you need a 900% gain just to get back to even.
Ooh, yeah, that's a steep climb.
So avoiding those deep losses is
Yeah.
paramount, just critical.
Okay, so for you listening, we're distilling Graham's core mindset into three powerful lessons today. First, how to minimize the odds of suffering those irreversible losses.
Second, how to maximize your chances for sustainable, let's say, stress-free gains.
And third, maybe the most critical part, how to control that self-defeating behavior that plagues almost everyone in the market.
Right. So let's unpack this. And the place to start is that core distinction Graham insists on,
Yeah.
the difference between an investor and a speculator.
Okay. Lay it out for us. What's the difference?
He draws a really clear line. An investment operation is one which, on thorough analysis, offers safety of principal and a satisfactory return. Simple as that.
And anything else?
Anything else is speculation, period. Doesn't matter how exciting the potential upside looks, if it doesn't meet those requirements, it's speculating.
That definition immediately flags a huge behavioral cost, doesn't it? Speculation isn't just risking your capital, it's the cost of activity itself. You often hear that brokerage houses, well, they always cheer at the closing bell. Why? Because they make money whenever you trade.
It's completely true. By speculating, by trading frequently, you're actually lowering your own odds of building wealth.
I'm raising someone else's.
Yeah, the intermediaries, the brokers, the platforms. Speed is like the absolute enemy of intelligent investing.
All the day trading, the constant real-time data. Graham warned it turned the market into a kind of non-stop national video game.
He did, and the evidence backs him up overwhelmingly.
Yeah, tell us about that study. It's pretty damning.
It is. They looked at over 66,000 active traders, the most active ones, the people churning more than 20% of their holdings every month.
Okay.
Before cost, they maybe slightly beat the market. But after factoring in trading costs, they underperformed by an abysmal 6.4 percentage points per year.
6.4% worse than the market, just from trading too much.
That's pure value destruction, driven entirely by activity. It just proves Graham's famous line, right? Don't just do something, stand there.
Patience. It really is a virtue here.
Maybe the most profitable characteristic you can have.
And that patience also means avoiding the latest fads, the hot stocks. Graham warns about this explicitly.
He does. He says the aggressive investor, the one buying new offerings or hot issues for a quick profit, they're almost certain to be true in the long run to get the opposite result.
So the hype is usually just that hype.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
For every big IPO winner like a Microsoft that everyone remembers, there are literally thousands of losers we just forget about.
Right. The survivorship bias, that illusion of the quick win is potent but mostly destructive.
And this leads us right into Graham's most brilliant idea, I think, the core mindset, Mr. Market.
Ah, Mr. Market. It's such a fantastic metaphor. Explain him for us.
Okay, so imagine you have this business partner, Mr. Market. He shows up every single day, and he quotes you a price. He offers to buy your shares or sell you more.
Every day, rain or shine.
Every day. But here's the thing. Mr. Market is emotional. Sometimes, Graham said, his idea of value seems a little short of silly. He gets swept up in crazy enthusiasm or crippling fear.
So he's manic depressive, basically.
You could say that. And the prudent response, Graham says, is to treat him like a servant, not a master.
Meaning.
You only do business with him when it serves your interest. Sell to him when he's euphoric and offers a ridiculously high price, buy from him when he's terrified, and quotes a ridiculously low one.
But you absolutely must not let his daily mood swings determine your own view of what your investment is actually worth.
Precisely. Don't let his panic become your panic.
Whoa.
Or his greed become your greed.
This changes everything. It forces that that emotional inversion we talked about earlier.
Yes. Graham learned from 1929 the great paradox of price. Intelligent investors realize stocks become more risky, not less, as their prices go up.
Because the margin of safety shrinks.
Exactly. And conversely, they become less risky as prices fall.
So, counterintuitively, the intelligent investor should almost dread a roaring bull market.
Fundamentally, yes. Because it makes good companies more expensive to buy. It reduces your future returns.
And they should welcome a bear market.
Welcome it. It puts stocks back on sale. It's an opportunity if you have cash and a long-term view.
Okay, so if short-term returns are basically hostage to Mr. Market's whims, what can we actually control?
Control. That's the investor's superpower. Graham highlights five key things.
Let's hear them.
Okay, one, brokerage and ownership costs. Keep them low. Two, your expectations. Be realistic. Don't indulge in fantasy.
Right.
Three, risk. Control it through diversification and rebalancing your portfolio periodically. Four, your taxes. Manage those efficiently. And five, the most important one.
Let me guess. Your own behavior.
Your own behavior. Master yourself, Graham believed, and you've won half the battle. Maybe more than half.
To really hammer this home, imagine flipping on a financial news channel during a massive market crash.
Yeah.
But instead of panic and gloom, the banner flashing across the screen reads, "Sale! Stocks S 50% off."
Uh-huh. Wouldn't that be something?
And the anchor saying, "Surely, great news for buyers today. Stocks just got a lot cheaper." And the analysts are hoping prices drop another 15-25% for even better bargains.
That's it. That's the rational view for the long-term accumulator. Falling prices are good news, not bad. Celebrate the bear.
Okay, so self-control is maybe 90% of the battle, but Graham also gives us specific rules, right? A structure to enforce discipline.
Yes, he moves from mindset to mechanics. For the defensive investor, the one focused primarily on safety, he lays out a basic portfolio policy.
Which involves?
Dividing your funds. Simply put, between high-grade bonds or cash equivalents and a diversified list of high-grade common stocks.
And what's the split? Is there a rule for that?
A simple, firm rule. Never have less than 25% or more than 75% of your money in common stocks.
With the rest in bonds or cash.
Right, the inverse range. The standard default choice. Just keep it 50-50.
50% stocks, 50% bonds.
And then you rebalance. If the market moves significantly, say stocks run up and become 55% of your portfolio, you sell some stock and buy bonds to get back to 50-50. Or vice versa.
That sounds incredibly conservative, especially maybe for younger people saving for retirement decades away.
It is conservative. Graham prioritizes capital preservation above all else. Remember, 1929.
Fair point. Now, on the bond side, is he saying go buy individual bonds?
He's cautious there, too. He notes that unless you have, you know, substantial capital, he mentioned $100,000 or more back then, adjust for inflation to properly diversify across maybe 10 different issues.
To avoid one company defaulting and hitting you hard.
Exactly. Unless you can do that, buying individual bonds doesn't make much sense for most people. Low-cost bond funds are usually the superior and safer choice for the defensive investor.
Okay. And there's a specific warning he gives about preferred stocks. I thought those were kind of a middle ground, safer than common.
He calls them generally a worst of both worlds investment. Think about it. They're less secure than high-grade bonds if the company gets into trouble. Your claim is lower down the ladder.
Right.
But they usually offer less profit potential than common stocks because companies often have the right to call them to buy them back, typically when the company's doing well, which caps your upside.
So less safety than bonds, less upside than common stocks.
Got it. Let's turn to picking the actual stocks for this defensive investor. Graham gives seven criteria. It looks like a demanding list.
It is demanding. It's designed to be.
What's the overarching purpose behind these statistical rules? What are we really checking for?
Three main things, I'd say. One, balance sheet safety. Two, historical durability or stability. And three, valuation discipline, making sure you don't overpay.
Right.
The whole point is to remove guesswork, remove emotion, and ensure there's a quantifiable margin of safety built in before you buy.
All right, let's tick through them. First, safety in the balance sheet. Okay, rule one, adequate size. He suggested a minimum of $100 million in annual sales for industrial companies back then, basically big enough to weather some storms.
Makes sense.
Rule two, Crucially, strong financial condition. This is key. Current assets must be at least twice current liabilities.
The famous 2-to-1 current ratio.
That's the one. A non-negotiable safety check. And long-term debt shouldn't exceed book value or net tangible assets.
So the company has plenty of liquid assets to cover its short-term bills and isn't overloaded with debt. That's safety. What about historical durability?
Here, Graham wants proof of resilience. Rule 3, earnings stability. The company must have reported some positive earnings for its common stock in each of the last 10 years.
No chronic money losers.
Right. Rule 4, a dividend record, continuous dividend payments for at least the last 20 years.
Okay, hold on. 20 years of dividends. In today's market, with huge successful tech companies reinvesting everything and paying no dividends, isn't that rule a bit dated?
It's definitely extremely conservative, and that's the point. Graham isn't trying to find the next Amazon here.
He's trying not to find the next disaster.
Exactly. He wants companies so stable, so proven, that they've generated enough cash to reward shareholders consistently for decades through thick and thin. Reliability over rapid growth potential.
Okay. Fair enough for a defensive approach. Any other durability checks?
Yes. Rule 5. Earnings growth. He still wants some growth. A minimum 1/3 increase in per share earnings over the last 10 years, using 3-year averages at the beginning and end to smooth things out.
So stable, dividend paying, financially strong, reasonably large, and showing at least modest long-term growth.
That's the profile.
Finally, we get to valuation discipline. This is where so many people trip up, paying too much even for good companies. What are Graham's limits? And maybe quickly define PE and PB.
Sure. He uses two key ratios to prevent overpaying. First, Rule 6, a moderate PE ratio. PE is price to earnings. It's the current stock price divided by the company's annual earnings per share.
Tells you how many years of earnings it takes to pay back the price.
Kinda, yeah. Graham set the limit. The current price should not be more than 15 times the average earnings of the past 3 years.
15 times earnings? That screens out a lot of popular stocks today.
It certainly does. And the second ratio, Rule 7, moderate price assets ratio, or PB, price to book value.
Price relative to the company's net worth on its books.
Right. Tangible assets minus liabilities, the rule.
Right.
Current price, no more than 1.5 times the last reported book value.
So cheap relative to earnings and cheap relative to assets.
And then he has one final check, sort of a combination rule. The PE ratio multiplied by the PB ratio should not exceed 22.5.
Ah, so if it's a bit higher on one measure, say PE is 18, then PB must be really low, like 1.25 or less to compensate.
1.25 goes 22.5.
Exactly. It enforces discipline across both valuation metrics. If a company fails these simple statistical tests, the defensive investor just walks away, no questions asked. The margin of safety is built right into the purchase price through these rules. Okay, final segment. Avoiding the pitfalls of forecasting and maybe excessive sophistication.
Yes, because the big danger, especially in aggressive growth stock investing, is paying a price that assumes future growth that just isn't guaranteed.
Leaving no margin of safety if things don't pan out perfectly.
It's the illusion of predictability.
Mm.
Graham used the airlines industry in the 1970s as a classic example. Everyone could see air traffic was going to grow spectacularly. It had to.
Seemed like a sure bet.
So airline stocks became darlings. But even though passenger volume boomed, a mix of, you know, technological issues, fuel crises, and massive overexpansion led to fluctuating and even disastrous profit figures.
So the growth happened, but the profits didn't follow reliably.
Right. The experts forecasting smooth sailing and easy profits, they were completely wrong.
That sounds painfully familiar. Let's fast forward. Look at the dot-com boom, late 90s. Compare two companies, Emerson Electric versus EMC Corp.
Okay. Emerson. The steady, maybe boring, power tool and industrial controls maker. Increased earnings 42 years straight, paid dividends 43 years straight, traded at a reasonable maybe 17 or 18 times earnings.
The definition of a Graham-type stock, almost. An EMC.
EMC, the hot data storage company. Stock price went up something crazy like 81,000% in the 1990s. Paid no dividend. Traded at an astronomical 103 times earnings.
Wow. Polar opposites. What happened next when the bubble burst?
The comparison from 2000-2002 tells the story. Emerson, the boring one, ended up just about 4% below its 1999 price after the crash. Not great, but survived.
And EMC, the superstar.
EMC lost 88%, cumulatively. Wiped out.
88%.
The market, in the long run, valued the steady, predictable business far, far better than the high-flying, speculative glamour stock, even after its massive run-up.
Graham had a great warning about getting too complex, too fancy with predictions, didn't he?
He did. He said, essentially, The more elaborate and abstruse the mathematics, the more uncertain and speculative are the conclusions we draw.
So using super complex formulas to project huge growth rates way out into the future, that should be a warning sign.
A huge warning sign. It often means the operator is trying to substitute, you know, theoretical fantasy for practical experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's giving speculation the deceptive appearance of investment.
So the intelligent investor needs to look past the hype, past the fancy math, and watch out for accounting tricks, too.
Absolutely. Be skeptical. Look for specific accounting red flags designed to make things look better than they are.
Like what? Give us some examples.
Okay, first, completely ignore pro forma earnings. Pro forma literally means as if. These are basically fantasy financials showing how things might look if you ignore certain costs or realities.
Ignore generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP.
Exactly. GAAP is the standard. Pro forma is marketing. Ignore it. Second, be really wary of serial acquirers.
Companies that buy other companies all the time.
Yeah, companies averaging more than, say, 2 or 3 acquisitions a year. It can be a sign they're masking poor internal growth. Or maybe using accounting tricks related to acquisitions to boost short-term reported earnings. It warrants suspicion.
Okay. What else?
Finally, pay close attention to executive compensation and how it interacts with things like stock buybacks.
Buybacks are often presented as good for shareholders, returning cash.
They can be. But sometimes companies buy back stock simply to offset the dilution caused by handing out tons of stock options to executives.
Ah, so the buyback doesn't actually increase your ownership slice much. It just prevents it from shrinking due to options given to management. The cash benefits them more than you.
It can definitely work out that way. You need to look closely.
Okay, so this whole deep dive, it keeps coming back to the same core themes, doesn't it?
It really does.
The path to satisfactory investment results, it's not about having superior insight or being a brilliant forecaster or using complex math. It's about disciplined behavior.
Rule-based portfolio management.
And always prioritizing protection, that margin of safety, over chasing uncertain predictions. Being a rational business owner, not a gambler.
Couldn't say it better.
Yeah.
Graham's methods, you know, they created this kind of intellectual village of incredibly successful value investors.
Mm-hmm.
Warren Buffett famously called them Graham and Doddsville.
Right. And that leads perfectly into our final thought for you to mull over.
Okay.
Think about this. Despite countless academic studies on every tiny market variable imaginable, price momentum, volume, seasonality, company size, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
Why has there been virtually no significant academic interest in studying the specific methods used by this highly unusual concentration of successful value-oriented winners from Graham and Doddsville?
That's a great question.
What does that long-standing silence from both mainstream finance and academia tell you about the fundamental difference between, say, theoretical financial studies and the actual practice of successful long-term investing?
Yeah. What does that silence suggest?
Something to think about the next time you hear a complex market forecast or read a dense academic finance paper.